talk with them as I go through checkpoints going around Baghdad, and then oftentimes come upon them if they're providing security while they're doing operations or something. So I have had several chances to speak with them, and consistently morale is very low. If it's someone's first trip to Iraq, then the first month or two, they're in relatively decent spirits, saying, yes, I signed the dotted line, I'm over here to get the job done, you know, we have to do this, defend ourselves, blah, blah, blah. But consistently, once they've been there 3 or more months, morale is very low. And now we have a situation where this is becoming exponentially more so, because we have soldiers now going back for their third tour of duty already in Iraq, and we have others who have stayed longer than 1 month, 1 year at a time, but sometimes even 15 or even 16 or 17 months at a time. So morale is very, very low. I see soldiers going around who are very, very high on drugs and openly being abusive and threatening towards Iraqis. And at the same time, this is it's really very clear why this is happening, because they have been put in a very, very, in the middle of a very horrible guerrilla war. They are conventional military sent over to this country in a war based on lies. And they are put in a position where essentially anyone at any time could attack them. So they are basically on a shoot first, ask questions later policy, and very quick to demonize Iraqis and consider everyone there their enemy, which again is very, very similar to what happened in Vietnam.
Right, getting a little trigger happy, we might say.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Independent reports say that up to 100,000 Iraqis have, innocent Iraqis, I should say Iraqi civilians, have been killed. But the mainstream media and even websites like IraqBodyCount.net have a much, much lower number. Would you care to make a guesstimation on something like that?
Well, Iraq Body Count, they are a very good website, and they do a very good job, and their number is significantly lower than the finding released by the Lancet report of 98,000 dead civilians when it came out, which is now several months out of date. But there's two things I'll discuss about this figure. That I do think that the 100,000 is a bit inaccurate, but I think it's because it's too low. And I'll start with the Iraqi body count figure is quite a bit lower, because they don't report a death unless it's been confirmed by three different media sources. So that's why theirs is quite a bit lower than the Lancet survey, which basically surveyed families literally one at a time over certain survey groups throughout Iraq, and then extrapolated in order to conform to the general population. And they used a very scientific method, which has received the backing of many other medical journals since that has been released, and many other statistical experts. But the other reason that I think it's a bit too low is the fact that the base that they used to draw their conclusions was, they compared it to a baseline in Iraq as far as a number of people dead over the normal number of people who would die without a war, and their baseline was the years 2001 to 2003. So this was during the sanctions, where we had people dying from malnutrition and waterborne diseases on a daily basis. I mean, we had over 500,000 Iraqi children die during the sanctions. So they're using a situation like that as their baseline, a two-year baseline. So if we take that into account and adjust statistically, it could easily be argued that that number should be well over 200,000 dead.
Absolutely. I mean, people seem to forget that, the initial Iraq war happened in 91, I believe, and that we never really stopped bombing the country. And like you mentioned, the sanctions, devastated the country economically. Iraq went from being one of the most industrialized and advanced nations in the Arab world to what it is today, which sounds like rubble.
Yes, we really have devastated the country, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it could even be argued that it goes, the U.S. Assault on Iraq began even prior to the 91 Gulf War, because during the Iran-Iraq War, we were basically supplying both countries with arms and intelligence, and then it could be argued with the assistance of Saddam Hussein even prior to that. So Really, this has been a long, brutal, ongoing, hideous meddling of the U.S. in Iraq's affairs for well over 20 years. It could be argued even as possibly even over 30 years, with now this brutal occupation being just the current situation, which probably really, you know, it's one reason that I should also point out that the Bush administration has been extremely reluctant to put forth any sort of timetable of withdrawal, and it's because they really have no intentions of a complete withdrawal ever. There's already 4 permanent U.S. military bases there, 10 more in the works. Certainly they want to get the troop numbers down so they can use them for some of their other military adventures, but there's really no reasonable argument anyone could make who has any understanding of the situation that the U.S. has any intent to totally withdraw from Iraq, which, again, compared with the reasons given by the Bush administration and the reasons propagated by the U.S. media for justification for this war of weapons of mass destruction, right, links with Al-Qaeda, and then finally the favored reason now of liberating the Iraqi people. Really, none of this stands up, because there are no weapons of mass destruction there. After several search teams, many of which were sent by the Bush administration itself, have come up empty-handed. Bush himself admitting no links between the former regime and Al-Qaeda. And with Saddam gone, you could easily say, therefore, the Iraqi people are liberated. So that being said, their mission is indeed accomplished. So why are there any permanent U.S. military bases there, and why are troops there today at all? Why are they not bringing them back?
3 words: Operation Iraqi Liberation. And, of course, if we look at that acronym, OIL.
Well, exactly. It's part of the ongoing continuation of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, which means Iraq is simply the base camp, essentially, for ongoing military operations there, which I'm sure we're going to see a huge advancement thereof this summer.
Absolutely. Maybe just to finish up, we could kind of get, you kind of have perfectly segued into this, your opinions and maybe even predictions as to what is going to happen for not only the future of Iraq, but the future of the Middle East as a whole.
Well, it certainly is looking very grim right now. As long as this administration is in power and their policies allowed to continue to be pushed forward or inflicted upon that region, I should say, it looks very grim for the entire region, excepting Israel, of course. Really look at U.S. meddling in Lebanon and what has happened. Yes, some Syria is pulling out their troops, but we've had nothing but death and chaos in Lebanon. So if we look beyond the propaganda, what do we see as a result of U.S. meddling there? Same can be argued for Iraq, of course. And essentially, if this is the democracy, now the mood throughout the Middle East, people I speak with in Egypt or in Jordan when I've traveled there, and needless to say, Iraq, is if this is U.S. democracy and freedom, we don't want any part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a wonderful point to end up on right there, because I don't want any of it either. I just want to let all of our listeners know that Dar Jamel will be here in Santa Cruz this Saturday, April 9th, at, I believe, 7 p.m. does the event start?
I believe so.
Yes, 7 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Vets Hall, and that's 846 Front Street in Santa Cruz. And I just want to thank you again, Mr. Jamel.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides, special show today on April 7th with a number of guests. Well, we're going to begin with Michael Deal of Berkeley, probably in about 5 or 10 minutes, Berkeley activist, followed by, gosh, let me look at my roster here, Ann Fagan Ginger. Wow. A writer, an activist. I'm going to be a speaker here in Santa Cruz a week from tomorrow, and we're going to probably have her on again on Sunday. She's been studying and trying to find some real civil rights and civil liberties and deal with civil liberties abuses for decades. And then finally, around 7:40, we're going to have Peggy Kennedy, from Venice, California, down there near Los Angeles, talking about the attack on street performers and other activists along the Venice boardwalk and the new yuppie lottery that has kind of taken over down there. Stay with us.
Was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore my corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow. Smooth as let me back, but I'm a third class citizen. My wages tell me that, and I'm a first class engineer. The boss, he says, we pay you as a lady. You know you only got the job, cause I can't afford a man. With you I keep the profits high as maybe. You're just a cheaper pair of hands. You've got one fault, you're a woman. You're not worth the equal pay. A bitch or a tart, you're nothing but heart. Shallow and vain, you got no brain. You even go down the drain like a lady today. Well, I listened to my mother and I joined a typing pool. I listened to my lover and I put him through his school. But if I listen to the boss, I'm just a bloody fool and an underpaid engineer. I've been a sucker ever since I was a baby. As a daughter, as a wife, as a mother and a dear. But I'll fight them as a woman, not a lady. Fight them as an engineer.
And that, of course, was Peggy Seeger. I'm going to be an engineer, or I was going to be an engineer. That was one of the first songs of hers I ever heard, God, about 25, 30 years ago. And still a great song. Hey, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and this, of course, is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. I'm Bathrobes Pier, and here are my broadsides. You can orate a bit, too. Call-in number is 427-3772. We have three callers today, at least. I'm expecting to call in. Two of them from Berkeley, that's Ann Fagan Ginger and Michael Deal, and one of them from Venice, California, that's Peggy Kennedy, but we also hoping to have an update from the university on upcoming anti-war activity, strike activity up there, though that may be covered, I think, hopefully will be covered in some other shows that Free Radio does. I'm not quite sure who's going to be covering that, but I think it's a continuing subject of interest to a lot of broadcasters here. One subject that is of significant interest to me, of course, is the closing down of the Pacific Coast Cooperative, the cannabis club or distribution center, as they like to call it, that opened and was open for 6 weeks across from the Metro Bus Center downtown Santa Cruz, the only distribution center in Santa Cruz, open in 5 years since the Rotkin Fitzmaurice No Distribution Centers Thank You law, masquerading as a zoning ordinance that permits distribution centers. But nothing, no distribution center has been able to work its way through the tangles of the planning department to be able to open in Santa Cruz. Hence, in effect, medical marijuana has been illegalized for distribution since 2000 when the last club closed because of the tightening of that ordinance by Mayor Rotkin, now mayor, then council member, and Councilmember Fitzmaurice. Those are the two, I guess, and Matthews may well have been on the council, was on the council, I believe, at that time as well. These are the people who essentially created the law that shut down all medical marijuana distribution centers in Santa Cruz. They're the ones who have to change it, and I encourage you to give them a call at 420-5020 and tell them to get off the stick and do it fast. The city council has a meeting next Tuesday. People can, in theory, the council could, by an emergency ordinance, allow for the opening or the continuation of that club, which is, by all reports I've heard, and even nothing negative from the planning department other than the fact that they were not candid in saying that they were not opening a club, but they were, in fact, doing a business consulting deal because they wanted to serve people, they said, and because they felt that once they'd established themselves, the people would see the people, officials in power would see that it was a good thing they were doing. And you might say that at least they had 6 weeks of being able to serve people before the iron hand of the planning department came down and swept them away. I understand now they're looking for other locations. They're also encouraging people to call city council and intercede on their behalf. Again, the phone number 420-5020. And council has the power to change this. They could change it with an emergency ordinance next Tuesday. I'm not aware that any such ordinance is on the agenda yet, but since it's an emergency ordinance, it could be put on the agenda at any time prior to the Tuesday council meeting. Usually such ordinances require 72-hour notice. But Mayor Mike Rotkin, who is a member of the board of the American Civil Liberties Union and a great advocate of the rights of medical marijuana, has said he will refuse to allow the club to stay open in that area. He's proposing no changes that would allow Santa Cruz, like every other California city that has such laws, to allow clubs, at least some clubs in the downtown area. That's the liberal, the great liberal. And I'm going to be talking with some of our guests about this kind of liberal hypocrisy, where they're very liberal, posturing on national issues, international issues, and even on local issues insofar as the feds are concerned, like we support Valerie Corral and WHAM, the organization being attacked by the feds. But when it comes to our own medical marijuana folks here in town that are trying to distribute medical marijuana, we're not going to allow them to open anything up. And we'll, of course, go after young people who sell marijuana on the streets with felony prosecutions. That's the Mike Rotkin that I know. That's the real Mike Rotkin. That's the real mayor. That's although it has to be said that there are many sides to everyone, and I've invited Mayor Rotkin in the studio to come and discuss this issue. He has not seen fit to respond to my invitation. But, Mike, you're welcome to come in and talk. We've spoken before. Invite you to come on the air and talk about what you're going to do about the fact that Santa Cruz has zero medical marijuana distribution centers where people can walk in, present their card, present their doctor's letter, and get some decent medication without having to run around on the levee and buy it illegally in a dangerous, difficult situation. That's a question that has remained unanswered by you for 5 years. And it's a shame, and it's a disgrace. It's a scandal, particularly when you are supporting the closing down of the Pacific Coast Collective. It's also too bad the Good Times didn't see fit to put anything in its issue on that subject. The Good Times did a very good story last week on this, but this week I don't see anything in it. Of course, the Good Times usually has its stuff all arranged almost a week or two in advance, so I can understand that. But because of its responsibility, in a way, in getting the cannabis distribution center, the Pacific Coast Cooperative, closed down, I would have thought that the Good Times would have had the social responsibility or the common human decency to do a follow-up. Instead, there's this kind of what I consider a relatively slimy little story in the Metro yesterday by Sarah Phelan, who writes news, who sort of sneers at the club, suggesting that other people, old-timers, informed sources, are wondering if the club hasn't besmirched the reputation of the cannabis community by opening up under a pretext in order to get its medication out to poor people, because they're giving it away as well as selling it, according to what they say, and I've heard anything to the contrary. Instead of attacking or letting the community know about the Rotkin-Fitzmaurice laws that are prohibiting this and arousing community sentiment so they can change, Phelan and the Metro have done absolutely nothing to even let people know this is going on. Of course, the Sentinel is even worse, does nothing either. The one good news source for those who are interested is the Santa Cruz Indie Media, where yours truly is actually doing a lot of writing. I'm posting one article after another, and that's the good thing about indie media. You can always post your own articles, and you can respond to them. Unless you're writing a lot of stuff about Israel from the right or the pro-government position, in which case you may find yourself kicked off the air there, but that's another story. Still, it's one of my favorite news sources, and I'm pleased that at least somewhere something can get out. I hope that the community does something, and I hope you give a call to 420-5020 and demand that the city council do something, because I think that if they don't take the initiative, then the citizens should literally take the initiative and circulate an initiative to change this law. The problem with that, of course, is it requires money and organization, and it also requires some staying power, and I'm not sure what the Pacific Coast Cooperative folks are doing. You could also contact them and see what they want to do. And I think I have their number hidden away here somewhere, so you can perhaps, of course, when I want it, it's hard to find. Yeah, this is the good article last week. You can give a call to them and see if they have need any kind of assistance, and I hope you do help them. 454-0215, 454-0215. So let me kind of give an intro to Berkeley, because I think Michael will probably be calling in, though. He's a man on the streets. He's actually graduated with cell phone. He works with BOSS, which is it Better Outreach Support Services, something like that. It's one of the main, I call them the big three, one of the three large homeless organizations in the state. One of them is BOSS in Berkeley, one of them is the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco, and the third is the LA Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness in Los Angeles. They do a lot of good work, all three of them. I've also criticized them at different times for different things, but in the main, I think I've got a lot more to say in favor of than against them. And Michael has been working for years on the streets to secure civil rights and social services for homeless people in Berkeley. And I've interviewed him before on this show, and I hope he is able to get in on the line here. I think the phone is operational. Yeah, the phone's working. So let's hope that something is coming up soon there. Adjusting the ringer so it doesn't blow us away. What else is cooking here? Bill Motto Post is their vets, of course, in Santa Cruz. They're going to be commemorating the War Dead, according to a post by Ann Simonton, a free radio broadcaster, on Sunday. The Sunday coming up, April 10th at 1 p.m. That's 3 days away. In front of the post office, downtown Santa Cruz, they invite you to join them in commemorating those who have died in Iraq. Wreaths for U.S. soldiers as well as for the people they killed. That's very nice. It is nice. It's good that we remember that. It's good that we raise the issue as loudly and as strongly as we can. And I was pleased to hear about the successful protests against the military recruiters on campus up at UCSC. There was an interesting show last night, Talk About had stuff on that. That's a KZSC show. And I'm hoping to get a kind of not only a report from that scene, and I think I actually did record a report by the erstwhile activist John Teelking, who was up there checking things out. I don't know if we're going to get to that today. It probably isn't going to happen at today. Here's a little something I was going to play actually a couple months ago. Who knows? Maybe I've already played it. It's a tape of a woman seeking medical marijuana, a disabled person, talking about it and not able to do it. She's called into the show before. I'm going to play the first contact I had with her recently. I think it's worth listening to.
This is an ordinance amendment, section 16.04.08.
We're talking with
Megan Andrea Morgan.
Okay, you came to City Council. We're outside Council Chambers, and it's about 8:45. And you've got a walker. He's also a sitter, it looks like. So he kind of doubles a chair and also something you lean against as you walk. Why'd you come down to City Council tonight?
Well, I've been interested in the issues that I have been watching on television. I haven't been able to get down here in person because I do struggle from too much physical pain. Issues about the school safety, the medical marijuana, and some of the other stuff too, environmental issues, landfill issues, and all that kind of stuff. But particularly tonight, the medical marijuana issue stood out to me because I have applied for the car and I've been approved for medical marijuana. However, there's so much red tape and bureaucracy that I can't have access to anything. And I actually wanted to speak with a gentleman that was in here earlier that spoke up for medical marijuana rights, but he's left already.
Michael Tomasi.
Yeah, Michael Tomasi. But
around City Hall during the day. He's a vet who lives in his vehicle, and in fact, he may be back this evening. He may even show up again. Have you? What has happened? We know distribution centers have been closed down in Santa Cruz since 2000. How long have you needed medical marijuana?
Well, I've been needing it for quite some time. I've been smoking it for a while, but just in the last few months that I have seen a doctor that had approved me. I've got the ID card.
What do you use it for?
I do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, have some issues linked to depression, and I also smoke it because I suffer from osteoarthritis and another condition called fibromyalgia and myofascial pain syndrome, which is...
And we're going to interrupt that taped interview because we actually have a live person on the phone who's also a medical marijuana user. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, just fine. I just tuned in the show. I wanted to tell you this is my first time calling in, but not my first time listening. I listen on the Internet, and I really appreciate your radio station. I also use it, put your radio station as a tagline for other people to read when I post messages on the various bullet boards that I frequent.
Where are you calling from? I'm talking to Ernie, right?
Yes. Stanislaus County.
Wow.
We're north of you, and we're one place that just got our first medical marijuana shop. Unfortunately, Stanislaus County has followed the political practice of providing only monopoly concession. They did it with the cable company, and they've done it with the only medical club we have. It's a step forward, but monopoly is not the answer.
Well, at least you have a club. We don't even have a club here that's open, and we're supposedly the great pioneers. But how long has this been open?
I think we're going on our first month.
And what have people done prior to this?
Well, I used to go down to Berkeley. I was a member at Berkeley, but of course I've had to learn how to grow my own. It's quite an art, if I may. There are many bulletin boards and groups on the Internet that can help you with supporting for medical grow.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that as well. I would love to talk to you more about where you're from and what you've been up to, but I've got another guest scheduled. So,
well, thank you for letting me have some time.
Let me just thank you, too.
I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Ernie, and please call in again and keep us posted on what's going on in Stanislaus County.
That's right. Thank you.
All right, man. So, phone line is open, and I am hoping to get a call, as I was mentioning, from Berkeley. Michael Deal is an activist on the street there who has been organizing different protests, usually small tent cities, up on Telegraph Avenue, which is about four blocks from the university. There's a four-block area where a lot of people actually are allowed to sell their wares on the street, unlike in Santa Cruz, where if you try that, they will harass you or haul you away. And apparently in Venice, it's now becoming a difficult situation for people, too, which we'll hear about that later in the show. I'm going to get back to Megan, however. We were listening to a taped interview with her, and until I get the word that we actually can get Michael on the phone, and then we'll pick it up with Michael in Berkeley.
Painful. It affects me from my neck all the way through my whole body to my hands and my feet. And I smoke marijuana because it helps me to relax, it helps me to sleep, and it also helps me to want to eat because my doctor does prescribe a heavy narcotic pain medication. So
how have you? What do you do when you want to get marijuana in Santa Cruz? You head for the levee? Do you go downtown and try to duck the DEA or the local CNET as they go after hippie and youth downtown who are selling on Pacific Avenue? What do you do to get medical marijuana?
Well, I can say that it's very tough. And when I saw the gentleman that stood up earlier this evening speaking out about the medical marijuana, it prompted me to come down here because I was going to ask him if there was some route that he knew that I could take, that I could get something. So far, I've been lucky. I've had a few friends help me out here and there. But as of today, tonight, I don't have anything. And it does worry me, particularly because I do suffer from PTSD and depression. And I've been real close to needing to go to the mental health unit because I'm having really a lot of trouble dealing with my stress. And if I don't get something, it's going to get worse.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know there's no... It's that distribution center, except Wham is a distribution center. It's a collective, and you have to be inside it. They grow their own. Perhaps, Sergeant Flippo, you got any medical marijuana on you? No, apparently not. Well, send her down. We got a woman here who needs some. So, I don't know if Michael can help you or not. I mean, he may still be around, but I don't, you know, I mean, obviously it's a criminal offense to help people with medical marijuana, not in California, but of course federally, and the state police and the city police enforce the state law, which criminalizes even, you know, sales of marijuana. Well, although I guess theoretically you could sell it if you're a, you know, medical marijuana provider, or give it away or do it for a cause. If anybody can help, if you want to call the Huff line, if you have any grass for distribution to medical marijuana patients, give a call to 423-HUFF. And again, we're talking with
Megan Andrea Morgan.
We actually, at one time, Huff had a project called Huff and Puff, which was concerned with distributing free medical marijuana on the streets, but we lost our distributor. If I had a joint, I'd give you one, but I don't.
That's okay. Part of the problem is I've been trying for about a month and a half now. I keep calling Wham back, and they keep telling me they're going to send me the application to get on the waiting list, and they keep telling me, oh, it's going to be a long, long time, and I keep answering them back, yes, I know, but could you please get me the application so I at least get on the waiting list? And here it's been like a month and a half, going on 2 months, and they still haven't gotten it to me, even though they said it's in the mail. The other problem is I got my ID card through the county. I called an Aptos number, and the girl I spoke with said that I couldn't even go to their dispensary on 17th Avenue because I would have had to get my ID card through them and not the county. So I'm really...
It's a scam to make you pay for an ID card through them.
Yes, which cost me $35, which I did not have, and as far as I can see, it's almost virtually useless. I don't have any marijuana. I can't get any marijuana, but I have the card. A lot of good it does me, huh?
Yeah. Well, I talked today to Mayor Rotkin about medical marijuana, and he claimed that nobody has approached him about the need for medical marijuana in the last year, although I have repeatedly, so maybe he meant everybody but me. The city, through him and Fitzmaurice, essentially criminalized the distribution centers. You may remember there was a cannabis club in town. There are several, but they were all shut down. And the new ones that attempted to open were discouraged from doing so by the kind of zoning regulations the city has and the kinds of requirements and that they do in terms of the ability of neighbors to shut these things down very quickly through the very restrictive procedures that they voted in. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I can't
manage all that. So we're here at 9:25 at Pizza My Heart. Again, we have Megan with us, Roger, etc., and, of course, two other Huff members, Coral Brun, city council candidate, and Gregory the Great, the musician of musicians. I can say that you were homeless when you got here 6 years ago?
16 years ago I was homeless, and I was sleeping one night at the Little Red Church, and just to get woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning with a police officer shining a flashlight in my face and kind of kicked me and nudged me with his foot and woke me up shining his flashlight in my face and gave me a camping ticket.
That was 1988, wasn't it?
Yep, sure was.
That was the year that they actually, not only did they raid the church outside, they actually raided the church inside. That was when David, what's his name, would tell people to run inside the church when the cops came. Are you thinking about the church across from the farmer's market?
Yes.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Maybe this was in the summer of 88?
Excuse me?
Summer of 88?
No, it was wintertime. It was cold.
Really?
Yeah.
They were still doing it in the winter.
That's about when I got harassed. September, October, it was starting to get cold. Slept in a cardboard box and got harassed in a cardboard box.
Oh, my God.
Those were the days. I'm not homeless anymore, I'm just nuts. And I need my medical marijuana so I don't freak out and, like, do something to somebody.
I think a very cruel part of it is that it's just played out of the hip pocket, that when they feel like enforcing it, they do, and when they don't, they don't. So there's no consistency. And, I mean, that just becomes de facto discrimination at the whim of the police officer. Today, I feel like picking on that one. Tomorrow, I feel like letting the other one go. Or even tomorrow, I feel like letting the same one go. And, I mean, when you can operate on that basis, there is no real law. So this is where we're at in Santa Cruz today. There's no real law against sleeping, but there's a law that says the police officer can pick and choose which person that's sleeping he can pick on.
So we've got a variety of issues we're working on here, and I guess tomorrow at the Huff meeting we'll work on some more of them, see where we're at. Anything more you want to say, Megan?
It sucks to be disabled in Santa Cruz and treated like a criminal because there is no compassion for disabled people here. People like me suffering from severe chronic pain in my whole body and severe chronic fatigue, and to be treated like a criminal. It's been pretty bad.
And your response to this has been to watch city council members much more closely. You were watching on television. You came down tonight after observing the scene.
And I've been recording these council meetings as well.
You've been keeping an eye on new council members like Tony Madrigal, who initially you were very hopeful for?
Yes, I've been following members before the elections, and I'm still following since the elections. And, you know, I want to see where some of these council members are going to be taking some of these issues, especially when it comes to seniors and people with disabilities like me. For example, they serve lunch at the Loudon Nelson Center at noon every day, Monday through Friday, but that's for seniors only. I can't go in there and get served lunch because I'm 38 years old. I'm not over 60, and I really think that that needs to be changed, because not only am I disabled, but I live alone, and my cats don't cook. Hell, they don't even do dishes or laundry. And there's days when I'm in so much pain, I can't get up and even make myself something to eat. So it'd be really nice to be able to go to the Loudon Nelson Center and get served a nice hot meal. So.
Thanks, Megan.
Sure.
And, boy, I got a lot of interviews kind of racked up from the past. I haven't had time to play, but I'm a lot of them are real good, and I'm really glad I got a chance to put Megan's thoughts out there. She calls in occasionally, and I, you know, her situation is just so average in Santa Cruz. People who, for different reasons, need medical marijuana just can't get access to it. And then when that kind of access opens up, city council just closes it down. I should say the planning department, with the support of the city council, closes it down. This is Free Radio you're listening to, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. If you happen to be listening on the net, phone number here is 831-427-3772. And shortly to be getting a call from Ann Fagan Ginger, who I'm going to tell you a little bit about. Ann has got a forthcoming book, Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11, and she is the executive director of the Michael John Civil Liberties Institute, Center for Human Rights and Peace Law, that she founded in 1965. I believe she's 80 or more these days, still kicking ass, sounds like to me. For years, she had been reporting every case she could find in her civil liberties docket raising an issue of freedom of speech, due process of law, or against racial discrimination. What I'm reading to you from here is, you know, I can't give you the author of this, but I suspect it's accurate. It's sort of a, probably from, maybe from the jacket of her book, or possibly Amazon.com, or possibly the Michael John Civil Liberties Institute. She could see that her docket brought together many lawyers, clients, and organizations and strengthened their work. The civil liberties docket, which she reported every case of civil liberties abuse she found. She used these cases in writing the first article on police misconduct litigation, the first book on minimizing racism in jury trials, the first manual for lawyers and counselors on draft law in the civil rights Vietnam War years, 67-69. Ginger had grown up in an English, Quaker, Irish Catholic, Lutheran Jewish, Midwestern journalist family, there you go, in East Lansing, Michigan. She liked to debate and to write and decided to become a labor lawyer. She worked her way through the University of Michigan as a secretary and typesetter. Then she married a soldier and earned a law degree at the University of Michigan in 1947. And I suspect this could be her calling in right now. Let's find out. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Robert, we have Ann Fagan Ginger here on the line.
Hey, Ann.
Yes.
Welcome to Free Radio.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I think we can hear you.
All right.
Say something else.
Well, I guess I should say this is Ann Fagan Ginger of Berkeley,
and
I'm glad to be on your radio show.
Hey, I'm glad to have you. I'm reading this description of your rich history here. Maybe I should read a few more lines, and you can interrupt me, or we can proceed to more specifics. But I was just mentioning that we got as far as the fact that you married a soldier, earned a law degree at the University of Michigan in 1947, Master of Law at Bolt Hall, U California in 1960. Boy, I mean, this is a dense biography we got here.
Well, you better put in the middle of there that of the 8 women student graduates in 1947 out of a class of 150, none of us got a job as a lawyer.
When did you get your first job?
Quite a while later as a lawyer, an actual job as a lawyer. I could go to court. I could represent clients. But no lawyer, even a progressive, even a Santa Cruz type, would hire a woman at that time.
Wow. Were there any women who headed legal firms of any kind?
Not that I know of.
Huh.
Well, I'm sure that there were women who were lawyers.
Yeah.
One of them was Carol King, and I wrote a book about her, but she didn't head a firm. She practiced law, and she didn't have any partners, and she had been in a firm, and in the end, it didn't work out, and so she went on her own.
It says that you started the Civil Liberties Docket, which is this a magazine, a periodical?
It was a periodical in 1955. I don't know if your listeners realize how many cases there were in 1955. It was 1 year after the Supreme Court had decided Brown against Board of Education.
Which, for those who don't know, desegregated the schools.
Well, it was supposed to.
Supposed
that was
to,
the
right.
problem. It said that separate schools that are separate but equal is not what is required under the 14th Amendment. So it didn't really desegregate the schools. It said that the schools must be desegregated.
But Eisenhower did nothing about it.
What?
But Eisenhower did nothing about it.
Well, it isn't just Eisenhower. None of the presidents did. It required a lot of action by the people in their local cities going to the school board and saying, we want you to do something about the segregation in this school. And that was true in the North as well as in the South.
Was it true where you were living?
Well, it was true when I moved to Berkeley in 1959, there were 3 junior high schools, and everybody knew one was white, one was black, and one was integrated. And it took us several years after that, working in the PTA and with the school board, to convince the school board they could not continue to have a white school and a black school. And in the end, they closed the black school and turned it into a 9th grade integrated school, and then they turned the white school into an integrated. So they had 2 integrated 7th and 8th graders and 1 integrated 9th grade. But it took some thinking on the part of the parents and the teachers and the school board to get there. So there was nothing automatic about it.
Gotcha.
Well, I did the docket in order to describe the hundreds of cases all across the country on school desegregation. But during that time also, there were a lot of other problems.
Like people being arrested. Before we skip to those, let me ask me, because I want to bring us up to date on the desegregation.
Sure.
You're still in Berkeley. In fact,
yes.
We're talking to you from Berkeley now.
Right.
What's the situation with racial discrimination in Berkeley and Oakland now?
I don't think the word discrimination helps in terms of Berkeley, but what has happened is that a lot of people who have some money have taken their children out of the public schools and put them into private schools, and they think they're going to get a better education. And they're absolutely wrong, in my opinion, because they may learn more out of books, but they're not going to learn about people. And if you don't sit next to a poor kid, if you're well-to-do and your parents have a steady job or stocks or whatever it may be, and you never sit next to a kid whose parents are not that well off, and if you're white and you never sit next to a black kid or a kid who's from an Hispanic family or Asian, you're not well-educated and you're not going to be prepared to live in the world.
Santa Cruz is getting yuppified, that's my view. What's happening in Berkeley? Are people being priced out, and is that having a racial impact as well?
Absolutely. There's a terrible problem. There used to be really 3 Berkeleys. In the hills were the wealthy people, by and large, or people who weren't wealthy but bought there a long time ago. And then in the center of the city, there was an integrated, less well-off middle grouping, and then down by the bay, there were largely people of color and people who didn't have much money. But that has changed, and the poor people, both black and white, are now being, pushed out by developers who say, I'm going to take over your building and redo it. And we have some rules that you have to have a certain percentage of the housing that goes for people of middle income, but the percentage is very low.
What about low income?
That's what I mean. The low-income housing is very limited now in Berkeley. And it has a racial impact, and it has an impact on the nature of the society.
We're talking with Ann Fagan Ginger, and for those who want to ask questions of Ann, you can do so by going on pagesincolor.com. Pagesincolor.com is a chat room, and just go on the internet, www.pagesincolor.com, and I will try to ask any questions that come up and pass them on to you, Ann. You were saying that in the 50s, you had a number of other reasons, a number of other concerns that the publication you were writing dealt with. You want to talk about that?
Nobody else ever tried to do what I did. The NAACP had cases that they wrote up that were largely involving school discrimination or other kinds. And then the ACLU would have cases on some violations of the due process or First Amendment. But the McCarthy period was a very horrible period. And I would say that it is now worse, just so that's clear. It's worse, but it's hitting different people, so a lot of people don't realize it. But in any case, I started collecting all the cases of people who were called before the Un-American Committee at the federal level, and then there were local Un-American Activities Committees in California, Ohio, and many other states, and I reported all those cases. And also there were many cases at that point of people trying to stop discrimination on the job and of against capital punishment and so forth. So it was really three broad categories, and I think your listeners may be helped because that's a lot of what I'm talking about, is there are three broad categories of human rights in the United States. One is the First Amendment, free speech, freedom of religion, and so forth, and that gets a certain amount of play, and that's basically called civil liberty, the liberty to do these things. The second big category is due process of law, the right to know why you were arrested, habeas corpus, the right not to be searched and seized or to be cruelly punished and so forth. That's due process of law, the procedures by which you are treated when you are arrested or get involved with the law. And the third category is equal protection or civil rights. And a lot of people don't realize this, but most of the cases that were won on civil rights or on civil liberties, that is on equal protection, no discrimination, or on free speech or freedom of religion, were actually run on due process grounds. Something about the procedure wasn't fair. And so the judge wasn't willing to say flatly, you have a right to free speech or freedom of assembly, or flatly, you have a right to be treated equally. They would say, the procedure used in your case was not fair. And that's an important thing for people to realize today.
Is that still true, with the cases that have come up in the last 2 years that you've been researching?
Well, it's interesting. There are very few cases because the people at Guantanamo are being denied their fundamental right to know what the charge is or to have a charge or to go before something that's a court. So the denial of due process is massive. The same is true, obviously, in Abu Ghraib. Those people are picked up, taken there, held there endlessly with no rights of any kind. So you don't get to the question of due process. But let me just ask you a question. How many cases do you think there have actually been arrests since 9/11 of people charged with terrorist acts and there's been a trial and a conviction? Guess how many in the whole country?
Terrorist convictions?
Conviction of somebody who was charged with a terrorist act, was tried in a court, and convicted. Guess how many there are?
Zero.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting facts, I mean, I couldn't have believed it until I got into this. One of the cases, I'm originally from Michigan, one of the cases where there were four convictions in Detroit of young Arab Americans, there were four of them were charged with big headlines, terrorist acts. In the end, they charged two of them with terrorist acts and two of them with having done something. They were Arab living in the United States, but they were not citizens, and they were charged with violations of their admission to the United States for overstaying their leave.
Mm-hmm.
All four were convicted, and Ashcroft, who was then Attorney General, made a big a press conference in Washington to boast about this. And then the judge in the case, the federal judge, had to be in touch with him and tell him he better not do this anymore because there had been serious complaints about misconduct by the U.S. attorney who had not turned over to the defense certain items that were required to be turned over and so forth. And so the attorney general shut up, and in due course, the Department of Justice had to do an investigation, and they had to request, I've never heard of this before actually in my life, they had to request the judge to overturn the convictions because they had been unfairly attained and that they should be retried. And when they were retried, the charges were different and they were the convictions were overturned and the judge released them as acquitted. So that's the one case they had in which they actually went through the procedure properly.
You know, in Santa Cruz, and it's probably true in Berkeley as well, in fact, most courts in the United States, most convictions happen by plea bargaining.
Yes.
How many people would you say have gone down because of Patriot Act and administrative 9/11 hysteria laws that, or the application of Clinton's nonsensical laws?
I think that there are hundreds of people. Well, I don't know whether I should say hundreds. There are many people who have plea bargained, and I do not have a record of even 1,000, I don't think, of those. The main people that we have to realize are now deported. They plea bargained to leave the United States rather than face the possibility of being sent to Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib or somewhere else where they would not be known. So the plea bargain was that they would simply leave.
And that's the fact that this has been hitting people who are not U.S. citizens has been one of the primary reasons that I guess people have been so slow to react to this?
Well, I think that's partly true. I also think we're on overload. I mean, I don't know what's happened in the libraries in Santa Cruz, but here in the Bay Area, they have no money to keep the libraries going, which is one problem we have to face. And the second problem is, are the libraries going to turn over the names of everyone who took out every book? So a lot of people are deeply troubled about the library question. It's not as basic as life or death or being deported or imprisoned, but it's a basic issue.
Why don't we go through the laws that you feel, the reason I'm making this kind of segregation is because it's sort of an opportunistic segregation. I want to appeal to people who are U.S. citizens to realize that they are vulnerable as well. But, I mean, a lot of these laws, of course, have their most severe impact on people who are not U.S. citizens.
Well, I don't really think that that's true.
I think
that the fact that we're in a war, which is a war, and you may call it an invasion, and that under the Constitution the president is required to ask Congress to declare war, and the president never did that. He never wrote a piece of paper saying these are the problems with this country, and therefore we need to go to war against this country or these countries. So the major problem that faces, I think, everyone in the United States, some people have relatives in the service or friends in the service or who have been in the service and may be recalled, is that we are now engaged in a war, certainly in Iraq, still to some degree in Afghanistan, and who knows where else the plan is to go to war. And without the declaration of war by Congress at the request of the president, listing the reasons for going to war, which would explain why the war can end when those reasons no longer exist. So that's a major issue, I think, with everyone.
Now, was that format followed, obviously, in the case of FDR's declaring war, it was because Hitler declared war on the U.S. first.
Well, no. The war... But that is not true. The United States went to war with Japan, Italy and Germany after Japan attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor.
Right, but I think Germany declared war prior to the formal U.S. declaration of war on Germany.
Well, the United States declared war on the three countries at one time.
Right.
At the request of Roosevelt. There was no declaration of
did they have similar findings that you suggest that were missing on October 2002 when the Congress passed this?
There was such a request for a declaration of war by Roosevelt in 1941 against Italy, Germany, and Japan. There was no such thing in the Korean War or in the Vietnam War or in the first Gulf War, and there has not been in many of the wars. But the reality is that there's a reason that it's in the Constitution. But even beyond that, and more important than that in a way, in 1941, when Pearl Harbor was attacked by Japan and the United States went to war with the three nations, there was no law saying that the United States would not go to war. But in 1945, and a lot of people may want to think about this, it's 60 years ago, in 1945, the United States worked in San Francisco with leaders of many other, with 50 other nations, to make a new rule called the United Nations Charter. And in the United Nations Charter, there is very specific language, which is very clear. Article 2.3, all members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. And 2.4 is even more specific. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity, as in Afghanistan, or the political independence, as in Iraq, of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. And when these words were written, every nation there had been in war. They knew what a war was. They knew what a threat of use of force was. And they knew that the people of the world would not pick up all of the horrible debris and deaths and bodies left after World War II if they thought there'd be another world war in another 20 years. And so the U.S. made a serious commitment not to use force or threat of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any other nation. And that is exactly what the U.S. government has been doing.
Since that time, actually.
Well, yes, but especially right now. Mm-hmm. And the difference now is that since 1941, and certainly today, we have over 10,000 nuclear weapons, of which I understand 7,000 are on trigger alert, so that at every moment we are threatening the world. And the reason that I sound sort of desperate, I think this will be resolved, but the reality is this is the first time in the history of the world when one nation had the ability to destroy all life on this planet, either through nuclear weapons or through environmental policy. And so the people in that nation, that's us, have a new responsibility to understand these things and work on them.
A lot of people have become kind of inured to this because, in fact, this capability has existed for about 30 or 40 years now.
Yes, but the fact that it has existed and not been used doesn't mean it will not be used, and you cannot be inured to something that is that much of a threat. I mean, we build...
I agree with you.
Yes.
But obviously the Congress doesn't.
I don't think the Congress is thinking. I don't think that they are able to get beyond their pocketbooks and their power, most of them. And this is a new situation that really needs to be addressed. And there are many good congressmen who are thinking. And I think one of the problems for the people of Santa Cruz and all of us is to find more effective ways of being in touch with our senators and Congress members so that they know what's on our mind at all times. And with the media, which, by and large, broadly speaking, when is the last time you heard the United Nations Charter mentioned in any newspaper from the New York Times, the L.A. Times, or any other newspaper or any major TV show, the actual phrase, the United Nations Charter?
Well, I think it's not taken seriously for a number of reasons, both from the right and the left. You know.
Well, as far as the left is concerned, I can tell you that anyone on the left who does not take the U.N. Charter seriously is making a serious mistake, because when you have a tool like the U.N. Charter that you can use, let me tell you, when I went to South Africa, In 2001, I also went in 1995, both times I was impressed with the fact that the people in South Africa were very proud of what they did to bring about the end of apartheid. And every one of them, when you talked to them, talked about the important role the United Nations General Assembly had played in letting the world know that apartheid existed, that apartheid is a crime, and they finally voted and decided that apartheid is a crime against humanity, which led to a boycott of buying goods from South Africa or traveling there. So nobody in South Africa was inured to the problem or willing to say that the UN was not a significant instrument.
Oh,
not
I hear
the
that.
Security Council,
no,
but the rest of the UN.
But I think that a lot of people regard the UN as being kind of a tool of the United States on the
left. But it simply isn't true.
You don't think so?
There are six. Let me just interrupt briefly.
No, please. Go ahead.
People say this all the time. The UN is not the Security Council. The UN is six organs, one of which is the Security Council, which the U.S. often runs. But there are five others the U.S. does not run. One is called the General Assembly. And if we could get the media to cover what the General Assembly is doing, which constantly votes down what the U.S. proposes, the Secretary General is often criticized for not running things. Under the U.N. Charter, the Secretary General does not have the power to run things.
Mm-hmm.
He's supposed to coordinate the activities of the other organs, and he does the best he can. Then there's something called the Economic and Social Council, which many people in the United States never heard of.
How much of the budget does the United States contribute to the UN?
25%. But just so you're clear,
The
total amount of budget, I think it's less than that now. I shouldn't say that. I would say it's probably around 20%. The two facts about what the U.S. contributes. One thing is, if you get more than 2 years behind, you lose your seat in the General Assembly. So the U.S. is always just short of 2 years behind. So right at this moment of 2005, the U.S. owes its dues for 2004 and 2003. And the second fact is that the total amount of money that the U.S. pays in dues to the U.N. is less than the United States government pays for its military marching bands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about military. I'm talking about marching bands.
Right, but my point, of course, was that in terms of the amount of money the UN has to work with, the U.S. has a disproportionate impact on
that. It has a disproportionate impact because of the amount of money we put in, and also because we are a large power and we have military weapons, and the other countries of the world are afraid to question us.
And the UN is based here, and of course, there's great economic power too.
You said what about the UN?
I say that also the U.N. is based in the United States.
Absolutely not. The U.N. is not based in the United States. It has one office in the United in New York. It also has an office in Geneva. The World Court is at The Hague. The U.N. has offices all over the world. We are falsely assuming things when we say it's based here. That's one of the bases, but not the only one.
Well, let me make another statement and get corrected, because I appreciate the corrections. The U.S. also has disproportionate economic power in the world, and that's one of the reasons I think that not only the U.S., but a number of nations follow the U.S.'s lead in this matter. But let me jump back to, unless you want to contradict that or have some amendment to that. I'm a sympathizer with the idea of using Nuremberg principles, U.N. Charter, Geneva Conventions as a sort of a yardstick and a way of not only addressing the Bush administration's criminal behavior, but also looking at local governments and how they treat poor people.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I would like nothing more than to have the UN investigate abuses of people, for example, under the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, where human beings are not allowed to sleep after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning. It's illegal for anyone to sleep outside, and the number of people who are homeless here is about 1,500 to 2,000.
Well, then what I would say to you, just to start with...
And the number of shelter beds is 150. So what I'm saying is there's a huge number of people after 11 o'clock at night if they fall asleep
here. Well, let me just tell you.
And tell me what to do. I'd like to hear about that.
Well, I can tell you a number of things.
Okay.
For one thing, you can come and listen to me give a lot more of this material a week from Friday night, April 15th at 7:30 at the Veterans Building in
Santa Cruz.
In Santa Cruz. But the second thing is to get a flavor of the content and the substance of the UN rules, which go beyond the U.S. rules about poor people. The UN Charter says every human being is entitled to dignity, and there's no dignity in being told you cannot sleep on the streets after 11 o'clock at night. So it is a fundamental violation of the commitment the U.S. made in the U.N. Charter. Now, what I did in Berkeley and what you can do in Santa Cruz is to have the City Council adopt Article 55 and 56 of the U.N. Charter as your local law. That's what happened in Berkeley. And Article 55 of the U.N. Charter is very explicit. I'm going to leave out the background words as to why to do this, but Article 55 says the United Nations shall promote in order to have peace and so forth. The United Nations shall promote higher standards of living, full employment, and conditions of economic and social progress and development. Now, that's a commitment. And if you can get this, that's A. And then C is universal respect for and observance of fundamental human rights and freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. And B says shall promote solutions of international economic, social, health, and related problems and international cultural and educational cooperation. And so if you take out the word the United Nations shall promote and you put in the word City of Santa Cruz, which is what I did, I put in the word City of Berkeley, and we adopted this.
What
year
was that?
And the next article says that all the nations shall cooperate with the UN and with each other. So I took that out and said the City of Berkeley shall cooperate with all the cities in the neighborhood, with the county and the state and the United States and the UN.
What year did you get this passed?
1990. We passed it in 1990. And immediately after that came the first Gulf War. And based on this resolution, the city council made a resolution that the city police in Berkeley and city officials would cooperate with all legal actions of the FBI or the INS coming into Berkeley looking for people who might look like Arabs or look like Iraqis or something. And we have used it many, many times to support the kinds of activities against unfair treatment of the homeless. That, you know, there are ordinances. I don't know if you have one in Santa Cruz, that any new building, any new apartment house has to have a certain number of spaces for people of low income. I don't know if you have
there's
that.
There's a rather minor inclusionary ordinance.
Well, if you were to adopt Article 55, a human rights ordinance for the city of Santa Cruz that talks about solutions of economic problems and higher standards of living and full employment, then you would have a basis for saying we need to insist that more of the new housing and the old housing be used for the homeless.
Right.
And that the
city,
county consciously build a program to look for jobs. You know, in the 30s, it wasn't automatic that there was a New Deal. It wasn't automatic that the WPA was created to find jobs for people who had no jobs. It wasn't automatic that the National Park Service was put into, or that we built roads that needed building, and the government did it. That was all due to pressure by people like the people of Santa Cruz.
I agree, and I guess, you know, one question I would ask you, I wish I had Michael Deal. He was going to call in earlier. I think I mentioned to you he's a Berkeley homeless union activist. What he would say about the impact of that particular resolution adopted by the Berkeley City Council. I mean, I actually am, you know, I'm a fan of such things. I've been trying to get the City Council of Santa Cruz for 2 years to adopt a resolution, which I know Arcata has adopted, urging the U.S. to get out of Iraq.
Right.
And they won't do it. They won't even put it on their agenda.
They might go a little further on this question, because the reality is it is not safe for anybody who's got money to live in a city with people who haven't got any money and are homeless, because when you're homeless, you get desperate. And that is true. And so no one is protected. No one is safe.
Well, no one is safe with nuclear weapons over our heads either. But unfortunately, we both look up and there they are, you know, and they're building more of them.
I think that what has to happen is that people like you and me and everybody else who cares about these things has to decide to all walk together. In other words, I can't just walk in a march for the homeless and not walk with the nuclear weapons people. And the nuclear weapons people may not care about the immigrant rights, but they care about something else.
Mm-hmm.
So if all of the groups, which you said are on the left, if all of the groups who believe in human rights were to march together, each with their own signs, but I don't know whether you call it the enemy, the people who are doing the wrong thing are all the same people, whether it is homelessness or nuclear weapons or not building enough schools or keeping the libraries open, all of these, it's the system.
Well, you also have a problem where you have a class division. I mean, we have someone like Mayor Mike Rotkin in town who's on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union, and he's a five-time mayor, and yet he supports the law that makes it criminal for homeless people to be arrested for sleeping at night. Not just outside, mind you, but even on much private property and in their own vehicles when they have no shelter.
Well, there's nothing automatic about the American Civil Liberties Union living up to the principles
certainly
of the people
not.
Who
yeah.
founded it, who
right.
were willing to go to jail, which hasn't happened in a long time with the ACLU.
Long live Baldwin. Where is he when we need him?
And Well, and even he had problems at certain times with how to behave during the McCarthy period.
Right, that's
so
true.
So there's nothing automatic about anybody, but let me give you a one tip, and that is, that's what's in this new book that we put out, Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11, which is a description of 180 different reports of violations of 30 different kinds of human rights. It's massive. It's encyclopedic, the problem. And I think one of the approaches is by making reports. And one kind of a report that you could make from Santa Cruz, you could make a question to the Office of Inspector General of the Housing and Urban Development Department in Washington. What is the Housing and Urban Development Department doing to help end homelessness in Santa Cruz? And you would file a complaint with the OIG, Office of Inspector General of the Housing and Urban Development Department, asking what the U.S. government is doing about the fact that homelessness is not becoming less in Santa Cruz. And you could send a copy then to three committees of the United Nations, each of which says, under a treaty, we've just talked about one treaty, there are three more, and under each of these treaties, the U.S. government is required to make a report. And the reporting does actually make a difference. When the world knows about the violations of human rights in the United States, it embarrasses enough government officials that something happens. So there is a convention on the elimination of racial discrimination. I don't know if you knew that. That was adopted by the U.S. Senate in 1994. And clearly much of the homelessness is based on race. So that's one place. There's a second very important treaty called the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. That's actually the title of the treaty. And the U.S. ratified it in 1994 and must make a report under it. And there's a third treaty called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And under each of these treaties, the U.S. government made a solemn commitment to make a report on a regular basis to the U.N. on what the problems are and what it's doing about them. And the reason I mention it particularly now for Santa Cruz is that the second report under each treaty must not only say what is happening at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. So another thing I did in Berkeley, and it was quite instructive to the people on the city council and to the people in the city, and that is, I convinced the city to file a report to the Human Rights Committee of the UN about what is happening to enforce that treaty in the city of Berkeley. Well, you could do the same thing, and now it's the second reports are due. And so actually, whether they know it or not, the city of Berkeley and city of Santa Cruz and your mayor are required at this point, they may not know it, to make a report to these three UN committees about what they're doing to improve the right, or to carry out the right to dignity of every person in Santa Cruz.
We're talking with Ann Fagan Ginger, who is the author of the forthcoming book. Has it been published yet?
It's coming out this week.
Okay. And let's see, the name of the book is Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11.
And we're giving it to these three committees as a report from the United States, you see. So they can use it. We actually handed copies of the pre-publication book to the United Nations Human Rights Committee last week, a week ago today in New York.
I like the idea, and in fact I'd encourage, I'd like to get to sit you down and actually draw up a kind of a template to pass on to other cities that could do something similar with their, because they may face similar ordinances that are repressive.
Well, the ordinance is actually in the back of the book, and the full text of the treaties that I've been talking about, mm-hmm. or those sections that relate to human rights violations, are in the back of the book, Chapter 6. And mm-hmm. Chapter 5 contains the ordinance that I wrote for Berkeley. It contains the Arcata Ordinance Against the Iraq War. It contains two resolutions for impeachment or considering impeachment of Bush.
Have you ever been able to successfully use any of this stuff in court proceedings in the last few years?
Well, yes, in a way I did, but I don't think that that's the way it's going to happen. The only way we change things is not today with the courts we've got in the courts. A lot of it's going to be done in the legislature. A lot of it's going to be done because agencies see that they're shamed into it. But yes, they were going to close the schools in Richmond, California about 10 or 12 years ago in March because they ran out of money. And so a lawsuit was filed to keep the schools open, and a lot of people quoted the 14th Amendment and so forth and so on. And I came in and quoted the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which we had just adopted, and the UN Charter. And the judge did not mention it in her opinion. She decided the right way. And when the city appealed to the state Supreme Court, they decided it the right way. And in a footnote, they said, well, we can't mention every legal argument that was made. So frequently, if you make a very strong argument, and there was applause when I made my pitch to the judge in a packed room, you know, 150 parents were there to keep the schools open, everybody applauded. And the judge later thanked me privately, but that doesn't mean that they're going to put it in their opinion. So I would say yes. I think using these, well, and we found 69 cases. The Mikkeljohn Civil Liberties Institute found 69 cases in which U.S. courts had used these treaties or the U.N. Charter to decide cases for what you would call our side, all kinds of cases, so that it does work. Not very many lawyers have been using them, but yes, you can use them.
I know you've also written about juries, and one of the issues in Santa Cruz that I raise frequently because of the seeming impossibility of stopping the drug prohibition war, which is having, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of casualties each year in terms of prison sentences, deaths, and all kinds of other things. But in Santa Cruz, you know, we have the criminalization of people for use of drugs, particularly use of marijuana. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I encourage people to fight this is, you know, protest, picketing, education, but also through informing citizens of their right to nullify as jury members. Mm-hmm. Have you had much success in getting and bringing these arguments about legality? And I guess there have been some successes in the 80s, I remember, but anything more recently about, you know, about how the international treaties are being violated by local laws? Have you had any kind of success through encouraging jury nullification through that kind of argument or something like that?
I think that jury nullification is very difficult to achieve. It's a very good idea, and I think people should understand it. When I was called for jury duty, I was not able to do the service on the jury, and I knew they wouldn't keep me, so I said in front of the court, I used the word jury nullification, and everybody could hear me. I was then quickly kicked off the jury list. But the concept of being an independent-minded thinker on a jury is critical, and I think the more the people in Santa Cruz understand this, that the idea of law in the United States is partly that it's written on a piece of paper, partly that it's written on the Constitution or the UN Charter and so forth, and partly that it's in the minds of the people, and that they have a right to think it through for themselves. And I think that concept is very important for people to understand.
Right, because for those who don't know, and I think most of our listeners probably do, the concept of jury nullification is the power of the jury to disregard the judge's instructions, even to disregard the actual law itself in the interests of justice.
I think that the value of, let me start over. I think what you've just said is very important. I also think changing the culture of the people is important, so that the people, and ultimately including government officials, understand that the most important issue that Santa Cruz faces today is not putting a lot of people in prison. And the other thing that's critical, under the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, it specifically says the sole purpose of incarceration is rehabilitation. The purpose is not punishment. And the U.S. signed that piece of paper and made a commitment so that if someone is taking drugs to the point where they are endangering their health or the health of somebody else, they may need help. But if the system is going to be that you're going to try and convict them, then the sentence would be one that would cause them to be able to be rehabilitated, not punished. And I think that that's what's critical, that we understand that the purpose of prison is not to build more prisons or to have more prison guards. The purpose is to rehabilitate people so that they can, as Malcolm X, while he was in prison, was rehabilitated, not because of the prison system, but because somebody gave him a book to read, which he read. And so I think that we have to rethink not just jury nullification, what juries do. We need to rethink, what kind of a society do we want to live in today, and do we want a society 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, if there's no Social Security, if there are lots of nuclear weapons, if the U.S. is king of the world, and we have surveillance all over?
As a practical activist, because you, a lot of what you say, though you are encyclopedic in your knowledge, is very practical. I mean, you're talking about how to address particular abuses.
Right.
You know, what we're facing in the legal system is a massive juggernaut that it goes on every day. It's kind of, I mean, it kind of sours me. I went to a party for a departing librarian, Pat Fremmer here, the law librarian for I don't know how many years, a sweet woman. And I know most of the judges in this town, and they're okay people. But every day they are ruining people's lives through implementing laws, particularly around the drug war. That's what I'm most sensitive to. And it just really disheartens me. And I'm always looking for ways to encourage people to stand up and fight this. And that's why it's really good to hear these suggestions. But do you have any other practical suggestions for encouraging people? I mean, not to roll over and play dead around these issues.
Well, the main reason is that if they roll over and play dead in two generations, there won't be anything. Because, as I tried to say before, this is the first time in the history of the world when one nation had the capacity to destroy all life on the planet through nuclear power, nuclear weapons. During the Soviet period, there was a counter. We now know it wasn't as big as it might have been, and we also know there were many weaknesses, but at least there was a counter force. Now there's no counter force except the one that we build in ourselves in this country. And I would just say to anybody who's getting disheartened, don't. I mean, the people of Germany, how would you have felt if you had lived in Germany during the 30s? And what happened? And it's fascinating. Somebody just found a book written by his father, who lived to be quite old, who lived through Nazi Germany as an anti-Nazi, who was not Jewish and was not a communist and was not a gay person and was therefore not killed or sent to a concentration camp. He lived a life. And you know what all he and his friends did? They made gardens. They wrote books about gardening, and they wrote recipe books, and they wrote memoirs. Well, that is the way Hitler stayed in power, because the decent people did not find ways of fighting back against the system while it was going on. And so I think with that lesson in mind, I think a lot of us need to find ways to garden a little less, or whatever it is we do, and take a walk, and the walk may be to City Hall with a picket sign. Or to write a report to the city and ask the city to send it to the Department of State and to the UN Human Rights Committee describing the things that are going on that are illegal.
If people want to access information on the Internet that might help them to prepare such complaints, where would you suggest they go? Or do you suggest simply they purchase your book? How much is your book, by the way?
$24.
And for those poor people who can't afford it, what do you suggest?
I suggest they get their library to get it. But also we have a web page, www.mcli.org. And it doesn't spell everything out. You're going to have to do some thinking, and you're going to have to find some lawyers to help you and some educators, some librarians. All of us are going to have to work together on this. I think it is important to think about the homeless. I think it is important to think about people being given drug convictions. I think that's very important. It is also important to think about the people who live nearby who are agricultural workers who are being deported, and they're now being brought into the country and then kicked out of the country. And it's important to think about the people from the Middle East who are citizens, who are now being stopped when they try to get on an airplane. It's important to think about the foreign students coming in who sign up to come to the United States, and then when they go home for the summer, they can't get back in. It's important to think about, see, the connection among all of these issues without being disheartened, and to gain strength from the fact that I'll help you on your issue if you will help me on my issue.
I agree. Again, the problem I find, and much as I agree with the broad coalition notion, is that it often sort of becomes a one-way sort of situation. But I'd like to see it operate productively, you know, back and forth. A lot of us have been fighting locally for reform of the local laws endlessly, and the same people who are big champions of international law, who oppose the war in Iraq, although they won't pass any resolutions at City Council about it, you know, who favor, rights for people in Nicaragua, rights for people distant countries,
yes,
don't want to apply those issues locally.
Well,
and, you know, that's,
you might read a book by a guy named Nelson Mandela.
I remember him.
The Long Walk to Freedom. Uh-huh. I really didn't want to read it because I was too busy, but I could not put it down because he describes over and over exactly what you're describing, that sometimes people would decide. But there's another book by another man whose name I hope I will remember, who's a Lithuanian Jew who came to South Africa and became a leader. He was white, and he didn't have to do this, except he did have to do this because he knew that what was happening in South Africa to black people is what had happened to Jewish people in Lithuania and in Poland and so forth, and he knew that he could not stop. And I may think of his name, and if I don't, somebody can ask in the library for a biography of a Jewish man who became a leader in the South African government. You can't get discouraged. There's no place to go except forward. And we're all going to have to learn in new ways at this time how to work together. The war in Iraq, there will be a draft in all likelihood. Is it going to take a draft before some people who won't work on X now work on Y together? Maybe it will take that. But the issues are related. And therefore, the people working on these issues need to be related.
We're talking with Ann Fagan Ginger of Challenging U.S. Human Rights Violations Since 9/11, one of many books she's written. She's talking to us by phone from Berkeley. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org. Ann, I would love to continue talking to you. If you're going to be available on Sunday, I'd love to pick up this conversation if you feel you have the energy or the interest to do it.
I'll try. Give me a call, and I'll see whether I can do that.
Okay, and in the event, of course, that we can't do that, you do have an appearance coming up here at the Vets Hall Friday night next week from tomorrow. And let me see if I can get the exact time. Is 7 or
7:30?
7:30. And is there a cost?
Not that I know of.
Oh, wow.
I can't answer that.
I'm going to try to get the library to get your book if it doesn't already have it. And I will hope to talk to you again or perhaps be in touch with you by email if I... You know, if I can, and I do appreciate your running, well, touching very, very briefly on a very dense, rich, not only your rich career, but, you know, what needs to be done to deal with the questions that we're facing here.
Let me say, I give a lot of presentations, and at the end of every one, I ask everyone to stand in a circle, cross our hands, and hold hands, and sing, "We Shall Overcome." And I think it's really time when we all need to realize that the African-American community did hold hands together and sang, "We Shall Overcome," so that they had the courage to do the things that were most heroic, which helped everyone in the United States, black, white, brown, yellow, and red. And I think that it's the idea that we shall overcome has to be true, or we wouldn't all still be around if our parents and grandparents and great-greats hadn't worked over the decades and the centuries for us to have progress away from simply killing somebody because they were poor or because they were different than we were or enslaving them. So I think I would like to close by just saying in my mind I'm singing "We Shall Overcome."
I do it with you. I'm a little hoarse today and a little embarrassed, but it may be, if there were more people in the room than just me and then you over in Berkeley, well, we shall overcome. If not us, people after us will.
All right.
Thank you for being with me, Ann. We're talking with Ann Fagan Ginger, and you can, again, check her out at the Vets Hall a week from Friday. I guess I'll try to give you more specific details on how to get tickets on that later in the show if I can get a hold of those. Thanks, Ann.
Yes.
And maybe on Sunday you'll be back.
All right.
Thanks. And you are, of course, as I mentioned, tuned to Free Radio. Phone lines are open in case you want to jump in on the line in the next 10 minutes before I pick up with our next guest, who's going to be calling in from Venice, California, and talking about the attack on street performers down there in Venice. Phone number here is 427-3772. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, this is Peggy Lee Kennedy.
Hey.
From Venice.
Just in a little early, but that's great.
Oh, I'm early. What time was I supposed to call in?
You did fine. You're doing good. I was expecting you a few minutes later, but you called actually just really adjust at the right time.
Okay.
So I'm looking over, I've got a kind of a a Christian Science Monitor article, which
right.
discusses what, well, what's been cooking in Venice. And, but, you know, I've got you on the line, so maybe I don't need to read that article. Maybe I should just sort of let you, or would you rather I read that and kind of, how would you like to be introduced?
Well, I have a lot of different titles, so it's up to you. I'm an activist with the Venice Santa Monica Food Not Bombs, and we set up on the boardwalk, and that's how we got involved in the free speech zone battle.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, let's. No, what I mean is the history of this. Let me actually read a few.
There's inaccuracies in that article.
Are there?
Yes, there are not 300 allocated spaces. There's only 154.
Let me do this. I'm going to start reading this article. When I reach a something that is inaccurate, I want you to interrupt.
Okay.
In Bohemian Zone of Free Spirits, can spaces be assigned? In the Bohemian Zone of Free Spirits, can spaces be assigned? Venice Beach may require peddlers to buy a $25 permit and participate in a twice-monthly lottery in order to claim a spot. Daniel B. Wood is writing this article in the Christian Science Monitor. One man juggles chainsaws while eating an apple. Another bellows with an echo effect that startled passersby. A third holds a sign, "Ninjas killed my family, need money for kung fu lessons." For decades, the two-mile oceanfront walk of Venice Beach has been a gathering place for the bohemian and the bikinied, the cosmic, the comical, and the countercultural. Its reputation for street performers, artists, you still there?
Yes.
Good. Musicians and free speech activists reaches into travel agencies from Sydney, Australia to Seoul, South Korea. Now, after decades of minor crackdowns, the city is taking steps that many say will do irreparable harm. The issue, a new ordinance, LA Municipal Code 42.15, requiring the ubiquitous peddlers to buy a $25 permit and participate in a twice-monthly lottery in order to claim a spot. Why don't we let you take it up from there?
Well, I would like to say that it has already done harm to people. A person who entered the lottery and did not get a space, I emailed and encouraged her to come to our Venice Free Speech Zone Association meeting, and she replied saying she was so upset she couldn't leave her house, but she wished us good luck at our meeting.
Tell us a little bit about this lottery and what it involves.
Well, first of all, you have to go buy a permit. And people, I've heard people say, oh, what's the big deal, a $25 permit. But, you know, that pretty much excluded the homeless people who didn't have $25 and needed their money to buy food. And that was, those people were eliminated, partially eliminated from the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've bought the permit, your picture is put on it. You have to fill out a form and sign an agreement to 3 pages of rules.
Now, what did this lottery and this photograph and the rules replace? What was the situation previously?
It was basically a free zone. People came and they set up and they worked it out. And sometimes there were arguments, but mostly people worked it out and they self-regulated and they had been expressing themselves in that area for over 30 years.
Now, is it,
successfully self-regulating themselves,
I might
add.
Is this kind of like a specialized area, unlike Santa Monica to the north and, I don't know, Long Beach to
right.
the south?
Well, the free speech zone is a very special area. Actually, LAMC, that's a city law, previously protected the area for First Amendment activities. If you went down there and you set up a display or you had your art or you had a political table or what have you, juggled knives, you know, you could collect donations. And you were being protected under this city law. Now they've amended that city law and changed it from a 3/4-page law into a 3 or 4-page law with an accompanying 3.5 pages of rules that get changed at will by the Department of Rec and Parks that are so complicated and so restricting that it now does the opposite of what it did originally, which was protect First Amendment rights in the area. It now restricts First Amendment rights
didn't
in the area, and people are getting tickets for protesting.
Peggy, didn't Venice have a sort of a neighborhood council that was addressing these issues for a couple of years that had sort of some autonomy or some power in terms of legislative power?
Venice, all of L.A. City, has the opportunity to create neighborhood councils. This is relatively new in city politics, the neighborhood council thing, where you create this organization, and in the city chart, it states that the city council basically have to use these city neighborhood councils as advisory bodies. But unfortunately, these neighborhood councils are springing out of organizations like Neighborhood Watch and business associations and homeowner groups, Chamber of Commerce. And in Venice, what happened in June 2003, there was effectively a progressive takeover through a landslide election. Unfortunately, the city council woman in our council district didn't read the city charter that, or maybe she forgot it or ignored it, that said we were supposed to be an advisory body, and she didn't use us. She used another organization that was mainly people interested in property development and property profit.
Well, it sounds
of
like
development
so,
on the boardwalk.
So this was an intentional choice to ignore the will of the voters, and she wasn't using the advisory council that was voted in.
Correct. She used an organization called the Boardwalk Association, and they are have been solely based in meeting in a cafe called Sidewalk Cafe, and Sidewalk Enterprises are some of the main players. In fact, the players on this crafting the first draft of this ordinance with the assistance of the city council deputy in Venice were people heavily vested in profit through development on the boardwalk, no doubt. And we didn't find out. I was elected to the neighborhood council. I was in that landslide election and Grassroots Venice Neighborhood Council. We didn't even know. We found out about it clandestinely, this draft ordinance, and we had to beg for a copy of the draft. It had already gone out of the hands of the maker, original draft makers, into the Department of Rec and Parks, and to the city attorney's office before we ever got a copy.
This is the ordinance that set up a lottery, and essentially what the ordinance does, tell us exactly what the ordinance does.
Well, first of all, you have to meet at this Park and Rec building twice a month to throw your permit in a hopper, and they churn it up, people wait for hours in line. It's awful. It's very humiliating to the people who eventually don't get their names called. And then you're called on a loudspeaker if you get a space, and it's like you just won something. And then basically you own that space for 2 weeks. The space will remain empty quite often because people are winning these spaces for the sole purpose of leaving it empty, or they just wanted to come out on the weekend and they wanted to make sure they had a space reserved for them. And it's just a fiasco. The police are giving tickets to people who are practicing their First Amendment rights, protesting the lottery in those empty spaces. And it's a misdemeanor ticket, punishable, first-time offense punishable by up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine.
And have any of these, first of all, how long has the law been in effect?
The law has been in effect it's actually an amendment of a law. It's a 3.5-page amendment of a 3/4-page law. So it's like a whole new law almost. But it was passed October 27th, 2004. It went into effect the following December in 2004, but they didn't start enforcing it until March 1st of 2005. So this last month has been just a fiasco on the boardwalk. Just crazy.
So have any cases? First of all, tell me an example of some of the arrests and citations that have been given out under this law. Have you gotten any, or have you seen any been given out? Or?
Oh, yeah. I've witnessed quite a few tickets now, but no, they Food Not Bomb sets up down there, and they don't seem to have the guts to give us a ticket for some reason. They've just been giving us a ticket for unloading our vehicle and, blocking us in, just harassment tickets, like I'm blocking the road on a dead-end street, and they block me in with the black and white car with the lights on, and then put a ticket on my windshield. They're nuts, it's like harassment tickets for our Food Not Bombs, but, that's bad enough. But, and then they're surrounding us with all these, like an army of police when we show up. But what they are doing to a few other people that are maybe have less support. Maybe they think they have less support, I don't know, or maybe they want to get rid of them more. They're going up and they're watching them, and I believe they have undercover police setting them up, trying to give them money while they're protesting, and they're getting tickets for accepting money on the boardwalk without a permit, and just it's just really silly. They a gentleman said that somebody put $3 on his little perp. It was a vegan activist, an animal rights activist. Somebody put $3 on his table, and immediately after that, the police came and gave him a ticket. So things like that are happening down there, and all the people that are getting tickets are the people who are protesting. I mean, seriously, participating in First Amendment activity.
How much of a protest is happening, and how long has this been going on?
It's been going on since the lottery system went into effect March 1st. The protest is rough. People have caved in and got, some of the people have that were previously protesting have caved in and gotten, purchased lottery, you know, their little permits and entered the lottery, and unfortunately, like the last woman I told you about, didn't get a space and was very demoralized.
Mm-hmm.
But there still is a stronghold of people, somewhere between 15 and 30 of us at any given time, up and down the boardwalk, just, you know, holding our ground.
Now, are you... I noticed that the section of the law says, this section shall not prohibit the sale of merchandise constituting carrying or making a religious, political, philosophical, or ideological message or statement which is inextricably intertwined with the merchandise.
Right.
Are they still requiring you to get a lottery space to give out political literature?
Yes, absolutely.
Huh.
And, in fact, it's so one of the reasons that they said they had to create this insane, ridiculous, unnecessary, and totally un-Venice law was because they said there were too many commercial vendors down on the west side of the boardwalk that were competing with the businesses on the east side of the boardwalk. But in fact, yesterday I got a report from a witness yesterday where an officer, Peggy Susing, was walking up the boardwalk telling all the commercial vendors to put crosses on them so they wouldn't have to leave the boardwalk.
Because that would make them religious. So.
Right. So, I mean, just the whole thing is so insane, and really, it's very disruptive, and it's obviously the law is not meant to do what its premise is.
Do you have a cop watch in Venice? Like, do people run around with video cameras and keep an eye on the police?
Well, we don't have an official cop watch. You know, that would be us with our video cameras running around. Mm-hmm. So,
now, who is us? What organization are you with?
Food Not Bombs.
And how big is Food Not Bombs in Venice?
Food Not Bombs in Venice, we serve once a week,
uh-huh,
on Sundays, and we also serve in Santa Monica. So we serve anywhere from 200 to 250 people a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we have
You haven't been driven away by the Santa Monica don't serve food law yet?
No, they haven't driven us away from Santa Monica or Venice yet.
Uh-huh.
So we have a case right now in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here, Santa Monica Food Not Bombs versus the City of Santa Monica, and we're waiting for the decision, and we're biting our fingernails right now because oral argument was told in February. And also, another nice thing about the Venice Santa Monica Food Not Bombs is that we have an organization that's been helping us a lot, and they are called Axis of Justice. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
Saw them on the Internet today.
Oh, okay. Well, Axis of Justice, they have, been collecting a database of people that want to get involved at their concerts. And there's this wonderful woman that is the volunteer coordinator, Rosa Romero, working with Axis of Justice. And she's been coordinating volunteers for us, and they've been working closely with us. And Tom Morello comes and serves with us at least once a month.
How many tickets would you say have been issued since March 1st?
Probably 15 that I know of.
And are people together and kind of challenging those tickets, or are they kind of rolling over or separated? Is there any unity?
The people who are resisting are very unified in a lot of ways. We have We've sought support through the National Lawyers Guild, and they're researching the law right now, but in the meantime, and trying to figure out how they're going to help us, because there's a lot of problems with, you know, there's not a lot of lawyers taking pro bono cases and helping people for free. And
tell me about it.
It's really rough, and so you're limited to the one or two people that are getting grouchy because they're the only ones doing it. You know, so if there's any attorneys listening, that, you know, we could use more help.
Right, us too,
but,
up here.
Huh?
Yeah, I agree completely. But first, come to Santa Cruz, then go to Venice. Well, if you're in Venice, go to Venice first.
Yeah, well,
then.
We've got a lot of problems here, you know, and we have a lot more people too, so it's really hard. But a miracle happened for us when we were supporting homeless people that were getting misdemeanor tickets for living in their vehicles. I was calling different people that were lawyers and on the National Lawyers Guild, begging them to come and help this person because they were ganging up on them at the courthouse, trying to make them take these deals of stay-away orders on probation that they would have to violate because they can't have a home. You know, they're going to live in their vehicle when they walk out and accept that deal, so they're going to violate that probation. It's just, it was horrible. And stay-away orders from areas where the social services were.
What was the name of the case?
It's crazy.
Who was the defendant?
And a public defender.
No. Who was the victim?
The victim was a homeless person living in their vehicle.
What was his name?
It was a woman.
What was her name?
Eden.
And how did? And this was recently?
Yeah, this was last year. But when in doing this, and me calling and begging the different attorneys, please, and being willing to take time off work and camp out on these people's doorsteps, you know, the lawyers' doorsteps until they help this woman because, you know, she grew up here and I grew up here and, you know, I'm a renter and I'm next, you know, and I know it. So it's just awful. And plus, you know, when you're in food and op bombs, you get to know a lot of people are homeless and you really have a lot of emotional.
So did you get these yuppie lawyers off their skabooga and... Did they come down to court and help out?
All that overhead they're paying in their offices. And
so what happened? Did they come down and help?
Well, no. What happened was one of the attorneys contacted a public defender that belonged to the National Lawyers Guild, and he only took higher criminal cases or something. But he worked with us and he helped us and he helped create a model. And I have to tell you, our public defender's office have become really a blessing and an enlightened area of our lives. And, you know, and that's free legal help. And if there's any way, I would suggest, I know we came on right after Ann Fagan Ginger, and I really respect her. And, I mean, I'm really blown away that I'm on after her, but because I really think she's awesome. But I think that we have to start, like she has, I've heard her say in person, in a group when she was here speaking in Santa Monica, is we have to think out of the box, you know, and we got to think of new things to do. And going to the rallying with public defenders, you know, to get them involved with us was a new thing that I hadn't thought of, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, we call them often up here public pretenders because they're so prone to take, you know, to plead their people out. But I think that the other side of the coin is that public defenders have a really strong working everyday knowledge of a lot of the nuts and bolts of the law, which a lot of us, you know, who are not legally sophisticated don't have. Where currently, and I agree with you, I mean, I'd love to see public defenders jump into the fray. It hasn't happened here yet.
Well, that's now going to help our people that are getting tickets on the boardwalk is the public defenders.
Let me ask you first about this case. This has Eve's case or Eden's case? Mm-hmm. Has Eden's case actually set any kind of precedent or changed any policy?
It did. What happened was, one public defender helped her, but he inspired the other public defenders, I believe, or he's an activist, and I believe he inspired. There's other ones, and there are more of them there today. I think, you know, activism likes company, so it was a good thing that's happening. But what happened was he built a defense case for her and created a model. And let me tell you, I showed up to court with this woman 8 times. That's a lot because it costs $10 to park at this place. You know what I mean? Eight times I went with her, and we went eight times, and they finally dropped the case. Then, and it was like a, we weren't sure it was a victory, but it really was. So because we didn't get our day in court, and I think she was disappointed she didn't get her day in court.
Has she been rearrested?
No, she has not.
She's still been.
Let me finish that. I took on another person who got one of those same tickets,
mm-hmm.
and we went up to the courthouse, and they sent us out of the courtroom up to the prosecutor's office, the city prosecutor's office, city attorney,
mm-hmm.
and they are not prosecuting those cases anymore, and they just signed the back of his ticket.
Very good. However, are the police still arresting people for doing this?
Not that I know of.
And this is in Santa Monica and Venice, or just
Santa? Nope. Santa Monica is its own city. Mm-hmm. Venice is part of L.A. City.
So it's in Santa Monica only?
Santa Monica's a problem. They're now getting ready. They're now trying to pass a law. It's quite similar in Santa Monica. You know, it's just, they're just...
No, what I'm asking is, did Eden's case happen in Santa Monica or...
Venice.
It happened in Venice.
It happened in Venice.
We're running close to the end of the time here. Let me ask, what's your next move, and how can people help you?
Well, our next move right now is, is we're going to do a little kumbaya action, hands across the boardwalk on the Sunday the 17th, and we've decided it's going to be 2:00 starting at Windward and the boardwalk. But and we're thinking that maybe somebody will do something a little less kumbaya because we got some radical people with us, but. That's our media draw, hopefully. And if people want to know what they can do, they can always email me. I will respond the best I can because I get so many emails, but I promise you I will respond and try and give you direction on how you can help. It is humanrights@freevenice.org. That is my email, and my name is Peggy Lee Kennedy.
Humanrights@freevenice.org?
Correct.
You know, what can people do who might be able to send an email? Actually, we'll talk about this later because we haven't got the time, but you might draw up a list of council members, city police.
I have that.
And
I have quick lists for all the council members. We're in the middle of the election.
Right.
I have the...
if you can prepare that list.
I have it already.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is if you can prepare a statement that you want people to send and mm-hmm. the people to send it to,
yep.
then if people send you an email, you could sort of just quickly respond with that, and then they could, without, you know, spending a lot of money or spending a lot of time, still send in support.
Well, you know, and plus, I have that and much more I can get you to.
Right.
So that is the easiest thing I can give you to do.
Okay. Well, so if anybody wants to help restore some of the free, what do we call it, the free speech area, the free...
Free speech zone.
Along the Venice Beach.
Boardwalk. Yeah.
Beach
well,
boardwalk.
We used to have an elected city council person,
mm-hmm.
and it's been called the free speech zone for many years.
Right.
And she actually brought a motion to city council to declare it as a free speech zone, but it didn't pass. That was back in the 90s.
Right. Well, we can call it the slave speech zone now.
Well, we're still, some of us are having free speech there.
Well, listen, thank you for your free speech, and I will encourage people again to talk by email to Peggy Lee Kennedy. You can email her at humanrights@freevenice.org.
Correct.
Hey, thanks, Peggy.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And it's the last 5 minutes of the show. For anybody who got a quick comment or wants to spit out this or that, now's the time to call in, 427-3772, as I sort of begin to make my way, gather up my possessions, try to avoid... the wrath of the dentist as he sidles in. He isn't here yet, but should be here shortly. I'll be coming back on Sunday, maybe with some more from Ann Fagan and Ginger, and certainly with a lot more from other folks. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I just want to give the information about the Ann Fagan and Ginger event.
Please.
It is, I did this in the chat room, but it isn't getting through, I guess. April 15th, this is Mish, and I'm one of the organizers of it.
Yeah, I didn't see it in the
chat room. April 15th, Friday, at 8:00, not 7:30. He said 7:30, but it's 8.
Uh-huh.
And the donation is $5 to $15. No one turned away for lack of funds. Three local activist groups are co-sponsoring it. That's Santa Cruz 9/11 Truth Network, WILF, that's Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and the National Lawyers Guild. and come early because an overflow crowd is expected.
Wow. Thank you very much, and I want to thank you especially, Nish, for hooking us up.
Oh, I thought you were still on the air here.
Oh, we are still on the air.
Oh, you are. I'm hearing a different voice.
Well, you're probably, there's a delay. So you get to hear yourself in a few minutes. You'll be able to hear exactly what you're saying now.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to correct the 7:30.
So that's, again, 8 o'clock on Friday.
Friday at Vets Hall. And
week from tomorrow.
Pardon me?
A week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow.
All right.
Good.
Thank you.
Anyway, she was wonderful to listen to, and I'm really looking forward to Sunday. I hope she can be on with you again.
I do, too.
As you say, encyclopedic, and also very personal, right down to the the smallest jurisdictions in the country.
Yeah, she's got a lot of particularly practical suggestions,
yes.
Though they're unorthodox. I think that they're worth considering. No
oh
question.
Yeah. Well, they're all based on law, which is the best way to go.
Nice to have some law. Yeah.
Thank
Justice
you so
good
much,
too.
Robert.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye bye. And I'm gonna sort of say good night, I think, because I'm reaching that time. I'd like to point out that I am, in fact, the number one villain in Santa Cruz, according to the Metro. I haven't mentioned that on the air out of sheer modesty, but I have to finally proclaim it. Mayor Rotkin only got second choice. So I've invited the mayor to come on. We can have a villain mudslinging contest, or possibly just a discussion of medical marijuana and what to do next. But so far, the mayor has not seen fit to grace me with any response. But you can always call the mayor at 420-5023 and express your concerns. Why isn't this issue should be on next Tuesday's agenda? And, you know, I would bet you $55 that it isn't. Anyway, let's see if we can put some of these issues on the agenda, make some changes. And the way it's going to happen is if we do them, because they ain't going to happen otherwise. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Give a call to 423-HUFF off the air if you'd like, and I can pick up on that. And you can also rehear this at any time by going to www.huffsantacruz.org, and you can listen to the show again if you are a glutton for punishment. Thanks again. See you on Sunday, or perhaps I'll hear you on Sunday.
Mother was exotic, she was like a gypsy queen. I'd pretend she wasn't mine when I was 15. Her voice was loud, she wore men's shoes, she braided up her hair. Men would stop and stare. Her clothes were few and never new, she was always out of style. She was always nagging me, she'd treat me like a child. Sometimes I wished I had a mother like the rest. Sometimes she was so lovely that it took away my breath.
Most of the time my mum's okay, don't like it when she shouts and swears. She never listens to what I say, but tells me that she really cares. Calls me dear when Kevin's here, she's nasty when he's gone away. Thinks she's jealous cause I'm young and free and she's at work all day. Thinks I'm still her baby girl, she wants to run my life. Worries when I'm out at night, her temper's nearly bad as mine. Gran says Mom was just like me when she was in her teens. So why can't Mom leave me alone? She's always, always nagging me.
Where are you going? When will you be back? You're surely not going out looking like that. Dressed in black from head to toe, talks for hours on the phone. Why won't you tell me where you go? Wish for once you'd stay at home. Looks at me so blank and cold, a look that cuts me to the heart. Where's the child, the friend I had, the daughter like morning star? I know you go and sit in pubs, although you tell me that you don't. I know you have a lacy bra that opens down the front. I know you hang out with a gang, you don't know all I know. You never tell me anything, you just dress up and go.
Why should I tell you? I'll go where I want, I'll do what I want and say what I want. When I have a kid, I'll let her do her homework when she wants to do it. Tell her how it was for me and how my mother put me through it. I won't wait till her dad comes home to tell him all she's said and done. I hope that I won't have to work so hard and worry like my mom. Shakes me off when I try to touch her, throws herself at all the boys. Just can't think with her music blaring, she can't live without that noise. I'm in the kitchen making dinner, washing dishes in the dirt. Mom, have you seen my satin blouse and fixed the zipper on my skirt? I wish that I had looked so pretty, wish that I had had your style. Love it when you wear my clothes, I wish that we could talk a while. She rarely tells me where she goes, she never tells me what she does. With her friends she laughs and smiles, she's not like that with us.
I can take care of myself, you know, I'm not a baby, now leave me alone. My mum goes out to work all day. When she comes home, I make her tea. I can cook and sew and clean. None of my mates do that but me. Mum goes all coy about the boys, thinks I do more than I do. She never tells me what she does, but she's too old for that, I know. Wish that I was 18, wish that I lived on my own. When she gets that suffering look, I try to think of what I've done. Wants to hold me, wants to keep me, wants me in by 10:30. Every time I stand my ground, the same old chorus starts again.
Where are you going? When will you be back?
Where are you going? When will you be back? Where are you going? When will you be back? Where are you going? When will you be back? Sometimes I'm a stranger in my own skin.
I'm losing power,
giving in. She taught me to shop and to manage the house.
She taught me how to put makeup on and frowns when I wear my low-cut blouse.
My mom's there. When I need her, she's there.
Everyone needs something secret, something they don't have to share.
Don't make jokes in front of my mates, you look so silly when you do.
You won't come and I won't follow, don't know how to get through to you.
Most of the time my mom is right, but I'm not gonna tell her so.
You cope with the world much better than I did, you know things I'll never know.
Grant says you were just like me, and I say you're the same as her.
Goodbye baby, goodbye girl, welcome woman to the world.
Why do you make me feel so guilty, everything I say and do?
Those are the words of my old song, love, you're just singing a different tune.
La 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 la. La 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 think my song is funny. Well, it was not meant to be. Cause the world believes it when a man says, honey, you belong to me. But does it only happen to a poor man's wife or a so-called lower degree? Winnie is a lawyer's daughter. Sam's got a Ph.D.
Lucinda Williams here at Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM.